Hello there, I'm Tom.
And I'm Charlie.
And this is Tom Aspinall's podcast, mate. Let's talk about the guest today.
Sam Quirk, Olympic champion. Obviously, a big inspiration to you to get you on the shows after fighting. But yeah, we spoke about so much with Sam. Is there any hope that we could get you maybe? What are you thinking, Strictly? I'm a Celeb.
Right, absolutely no chance. Absolutely no chance. Sam's absolutely lovely. I've met Sam before a couple of times. But just to hear what she's done, because obviously hockey is like a pretty, it's not a big deal in the UK, and I'm not niche. Saying that in a, yeah, it's quite a niche sport. I'm not saying that in a disrespectful way. But Sam was talking about hockey career, post-Olympics, what she's done with her life, her being a mum, all that kind of stuff. So let's hear what Sam's got to say a little bit more.
We are at Champion Combat Centre and I'm Charlie Moose, your co-host for today. Just like you, just trying to find out of people at the top of their game, their story, mentality, mindset, all that good stuff. And who better to do it with than none other than the big timer himself, Tom Aspinall. Once upon a time, Mark Zuckerberg sent him a DM and you never responded, did you, mate?
No, I didn't know that he did send it me. So I did leave him hanging. But it's not about me today, is it? It's about, we've got a guest in the building. Sam Quirk is in. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of my socks? I've got to stop wearing them.
They're cool. Is it the Lion King?
I don't know what it is. It's like a baboon, isn't it? People keep giving me weird socks. Think I'll put them on. No one will see them, but then I can end up doing a podcast.
I can't believe you didn't reply to Zuckerberg. I feel special now that you actually replied to me.
Yeah.
But the big question is, Sam, does he follow you or not? That's what
I follow.
Don't know. Do you follow me?
I don't know. Do I not?
Can you have a look?
I'll tell you now, he doesn't follow.
Oh my God. You're the one saying, I'm sorry.
On social media. Jude Bellingham's in that list as well. There's a few that, yeah, but Sam Quirk.
I don't hit the follow back.
It's quite nice though. You don't like live.
I will follow you back.
It's tradition that I throw Tom under the bus, so I just had to do that because I love how he went to his socks because he knew exactly what I was going to go.
I honestly didn't know that I didn't follow you back, but I will. I will do.
When was the last time you guys saw each other? Because it was Question of Sport days, wasn't it?
You were the first MMA fighter to come on the show.
Was I the only one?
I think so.
Yeah. I didn't do well because anyone who doesn't know, Question of Sport is a questions about sport, basically. And the only sport I know is MMA, really. A bit more into football these days, but yeah, they were throwing all kinds. I was just quiet the whole time. Your knowledge on sport, though, is great. I remember that. You're massively in sport, are you, generally?
Yeah, I just love it.
All sports?
Most sports, yeah. I mean, no disrespect to like cricket, but I just find a sport that you stop for lunch, I'm a bit like, come on. Do you know what I mean? I like the 100, love the 100. It's quick, it's punchy, but test cricket and, you know, all these people, it's a purist's game. So boring.
Let me ask you this. Because you know what I'm going to ask. This has been an ongoing topic on this podcast for some reason. Would you say darts, pool, snooker, etc., are they a sport or a game?
I think they're a sport, aren't they? Because you have to have skill, precision.
Sam's also thinking about a career here.
I know,
What
qualifies then? Like, what makes it a sport?
Are you saying because you don't get hot, sweaty, heart rate?
I don't know. I was saying, who was I saying it to recently? I was saying it to somebody.
Yeah, because Leah obviously was professionally eating, she was saying.
So we had a girl in here, Leah Shukiva, who's a professional eater, and we were saying, is that a sport or is it?
Or like a hobby?
Well, because she was saying like to records and competition and that she's in rankings and stuff like that. So she was classing it as a sport, basically, wasn't she?
So do the ranking systems make it a sport or what makes
it a
sport?
That's a really good point. I did something around chess once and everyone.
Is chess a sport?
So they were saying it was because of the stress and your heart rate that it builds. But I think it's more like a mind game type of mind sport, isn't it? More psychological. But then I suppose sport is when it comes to tactics and strategy.
I'm going to have to chat GPT, aren't I? Like, what qualifies for it to be a sport? Because I would say that chess was a game. I would also argue that dance is a game.
Yeah.
But that might offend some people.
That's why we're never going to have Luke Littler on the podcast, basically.
Yeah, I know. We tried. He has ghosted us.
Talk about dance?
He said maybe, maybe not. But yeah, he's still playing hard to get. But it's actually, I wanted to ask you about that because when I was looking back at you were in all sorts of sports when you were growing up in Liverpool and stuff like that. Was it always hockey straight away or was there different sports?
No, I started, I mean, I've got a twin brother and an older brother and an older sister, but every day after school, we'd be out on the street playing football, Kirby, in the garden when it was summer. playing football, playing rugby, whatever the sport was, just messing about. So I naturally just picked up those sports. So I started off playing football in a boys' team from like the age of 8 all the way through. Got banned because I was a girl. Because again, girls didn't really play football with lads. You'd rock up to the park and I'd rock up to the games. And parents, players would look at me like, oh my God, they've got a girl. And I'd get one or two reactions during play. They'd either wipe me out because they didn't like me dribbling past, or they just wouldn't touch me because they were like, oh, I'm going to injure a girl. Whereas now you rock up to a park at a weekend and there's like girls playing with boys, there's girls teams. So yeah, that's where I really started like proper competitive sport in football.
Is that how you felt like you fell into hockey? Because it's interesting you even just saying that, because obviously hockey as well is super underfunded and that's tough. And you're coming from, you know, sort of where you've grown up going into those aspects. Was it genuinely just like pipeline dream? Obviously for you, Tom had his sort of dad sort of as guidance and going in that direction. What was the environment like for you to kind of get to that place in hockey?
I probably didn't realise to get to like, if I wanted to go to the Olympics until I was like 16, because I started off in football and then there was only two teams at the time I could join, and I ended up joining Tranmere Girls. I was just playing it for the fun. I enjoyed it. And then my dad, mum and dad working dead hard, managed to get us into a private school, which is where I picked up hockey. So when you talk about the accessibility to hockey, it's tough because it's a middle-class sport. Whereas footy, you just get a footy, don't you? And just play. You can play in the house, wherever you want to play, in the garden. And then once I got selected for like my local area, then county, then regionals, then I had the opportunity to go to like England under 16 trials. And that's when I realised it was an Olympic sport. Otherwise, I would never have known, because you didn't see it. Even women on football, I used to want to be Steve McManaman and my twin brother was Robbie Fowler. I didn't realise I could get to that level until I started representing the country. So probably later on, actually.
It's really interesting. What for you in MMA, do you feel like just having obviously the guidance of your dad, or do you feel like, because it's almost a bit underground sport in that aspect as well, to, you know, for an actual career path?
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know if you agree with this, Sam, but hockey is probably similar to MMA in that regard. It's like not a lot, well, maybe it's getting a little bit different now, but when I was younger, especially, not a lot of people, like, there was no career path to being like a professional MMA fighter. Was that similar for you with the hockey?
Yeah, I just didn't know you could. And even now it's not professional. So you only get money and the money's funded by UK Sport. So I was on like 12 and a half grand a year. And that's obviously tax-free because it's funded. And any money you wanted extra, you'd go and work and do whatever. But again, I think it comes, like you say, down to publicity and what people can see. Because now the amount of kids, like the following you've got, like Paddy, the more local Molly Meatball, who hear about the fighters going on to do well, who have got personality and a bit of something about them, it puts them on like the national stage and then the world stage. So then kids are looking up to you going, oh my God, he's amazing. I want to do that. I want to be in the ring. I want to have the opportunity to perform. And it's similar with like a hockey, but on obviously a very smaller scale. We really only get as a hockey player like one opportunity to be on the world stage, which is the Olympics. And even then you've probably got to get to the semi-final, final, because no one cares about hockey. No one did care about hockey until we won the gold medal. Then it had a massive peak. We had waiting lists at hockey clubs because there wasn't enough spaces for juniors, people coming back to play the sport. And you've got to maintain that a success, because if you're not winning, let's be honest, the product of the sport isn't great to watch. And that's just the fact. And then you've got to maintain what I always believe in, a little bit of stardom. So, you know, the personality, the little bit of something about them where it's the story, you want to follow the story, the person. And unfortunately for hockey, that just slowly dropped off and it hasn't really picked back up again.
So how did you do that then? Because that's really interesting. Because to be quite honest with you, I mean, I don't follow hockey, but you're the only person that I know in the public eye who does hockey. Mm-hmm. How did you make that transition then from being an Olympic hockey player or just being a hockey player in general, and then like transitioning and being more in the public eye to like where you are now?
Yeah. Oh God, good question. I think,
did you like have that in mind, or did that
I think like anything. And you speak to like athletes, you once you live the lifestyle of being an elite athlete, you know that you're only going to get out what you put in, and you've got to take risks. You've got to take the opportunities when they're there. You've got to put your neck on the line. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then it's only like the people, the majority of the people get to see you when you're at the top of your game. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, how did he get there? And then actually when you look back at the journey, like you say, it's the hand behind, the hand on the mic at hockey tournaments. I did like 2 weeks in Bhubaneswar on my own. Didn't know anyone, different culture, a little bit vulnerable, a little bit scared, but ultimately you put your neck on the line, you go out and actually you get a job done. You get the experience, you get the hours under your belt. But I started off at LFC TV because again, someone decided to give me an opportunity.
Whilst you were playing hockey?
No, so all this was all after the Olympics.
Okay.
For me, I just wanted to go to an Olympics. Once I got selected for the Olympics, then the team were like, right, okay, you know, you can now focus on what we're going to do to go and win a medal.
Before we get on to the transition, because I want to ask both of you this, because obviously you're going to have life after MMA as well, but was there a career-changing moment for you in hockey where you were like, because I know 2012, you had all of that going on as well, but similar, Tom spoke about it before, how he's, you know, quit MMA and said, I'm not doing it anymore, and then come back to it. But you had some time away from the sport, didn't you, before then coming back for 2016?
Yeah, because you're so engrossed in it, aren't you? You live it, yeah. You make sacrifices. And I got my first cap in 2007, one of the younger ones in the team. This was before Beijing 2008. I didn't get selected, but I never really thought I would because I was only like 17, 18. Then I went into the 2012 cycle. So you start training basically like 3-4 years before. Didn't get selected for 2012, probably lost my head a little bit, lost my way, lost my belief in myself and my ability. And then I literally went like Thailand, Vietnam, went and got leathered, did what I needed to do, just didn't think about hockey, and then came back with a bit of a clean slate. And I think that's what I needed. I needed a break. But also I didn't realise when you're part of a team, especially, it's really important that you have like cohesion and you respect all your teammates. And I think once we recognised as a team in the cycle up to 2016 that everyone's different and everybody processes their free time differently, reacts to kind of adversity differently, I think that's when you get something special. So for me, I realised I was trying to be this ultimate athlete. And like I am an athlete. I would took it very seriously. I'm dead competitive. But we used to train in 4 week blocks. And at the end of that 4 week block, I needed a big, massive piss up in Liverpool with my best mates, eat crap that whole weekend and then get back on it, train at home and then go back fresh on the following Monday. And I did the ultimate trying to be clean athlete for like 3 years. And I realised I just stopped really enjoying hockey. I know that that's different for everyone. And I think it's easier being in a team sport because it doesn't come down to weight, purely me on the track or in the ring or wherever it is. So I think I just had to shift my mindset. I mean, I don't know how you do it. Did you switch your mindset when you came back after your break?
It's, yeah, I did. Because I've had a couple long breaks, actually. And I'm unfortunately having a break now as well.
But like away from the sport when you said, I'm done.
Yeah, when you talked about, obviously, when you were sort of 17, 18, you were like, I can't do this. And even with the training.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I think I'm kind of at that point again. And I'm getting a bit older now. And I mean, I'm not like ready for retiring yet. But also, I've had to like look retirement in the face a couple of times where I've been like, I don't know if I'm really ready to do this yet. So I think it just like realigns the focus a little. It did for me anyway, where I'm like, oh, I've still got a bit in the tank. But it's interesting what you say about, because obviously I'm not involved with the team sport, but I train with other athletes who are doing the same sport as me. And a lot of people are like, big shout out to Phil DeFries, who we know. He comes here and trains with us, and I've trained with him for a long time. He parties out every weekend. Like, he gets pissed every weekend, eats shit every weekend, and that's when he performs his best. Yeah. Now, if I did that, I just wouldn't have any confidence at all. Like, the next week, I just couldn't go back to the gym and do it. But it's amazing the way that, like, your mind, different people have different, like, triggers.
So different. One of my housemates who I used to live with, she would obviously be part of the GB program. But on her week off or the weekends, when she had a spare day, she'd go and coach hockey or watch hockey.
Yeah, you need a break. I can't do that.
I couldn't do that. Like, I tried to do that because I thought, okay, well, in my spare time, I'll try. And it just didn't work because for me, there was no off switch.
Was that, Tom spoken about this before, was that an anxiety for you almost that it was just like so much pressure? Because you've talked about it having 6 months off now, that you've not had that day-to-day anxiety of like, I've got to eat this, I've got to train like that. Was that something similar for you when you had that time away?
Similar, I think. But even when I retired, I still had that for about 6 months. Like, I felt guilty, like, tucking into a Big Mac meal. And even when I had the week off and the weekend, it was almost like, not that I shouldn't, but I was like, I really fancy it, I'm going to do it. So I did still always have that guilt, but I think I just realized I just needed it. That's my personality. Yeah. It's not that I didn't take it any less serious, or that I wasn't, you know, I'd always be in the top five of fitness tests and stuff. You just have to find what works for you, because you've got to enjoy it at the end of the day, especially if you're going to get your face smashed in every week.
It's sound advice that I should probably listen to, because I'm very like that. Like, I'm put a lot of pressure on myself a lot of the time. And I am like, if I eat this, I do have to train tomorrow and it's going to be shit.
Yeah.
And then the day after that's going to be shit, because that one was shit. And I just, sometimes I struggle just to, like you say, just try and enjoy it. But when I do have these forced breaks, then I just think, oh, well, I've not actually got that long left doing this, so I might as well try and enjoy it while I can. Right, we are going to take a little break from the old podcast. I'm going to talk about our partners at The Prize Guy. Giving away something else they are, mate. What they're giving away today?
Oh, mate, I think you'll like this one. Of course, we've got £10,000 cash, so just put that in there. Just think about that. But we've got some Rolexes, mate. Ooh. So we've got a Rolex GMT Master 2 Batman. We've got a Pepsi. We've got a Bruce Wayne, a zombie, a Sprite, or a Batgirl. What are we going for?
I know for a fact, because I know a fair bit about watches, you see. I'm a bit of a watch collector. The Batgirls are going up big time. The Pepsis are going up. I would personally take a watch, because they are appreciating at the moment, and they will keep depreciating. 10 grand, it's a good amount of money. You can go fast.
Look, the part, and is it big enough, though, for your wrist?
I don't know what size. It didn't specify a size, did it? But it doesn't matter about the wrist. It's a little, like, even though you're not buying it, it's something that can make you money in the future. So if you're not going to wear it, keep it in the box.
Great prizes either way. But yeah, you can remember, go and check that out on thatprizeguy.co.uk. And mate, over to you to throw back to the episode.
Let's get in there, win a watch, win some cash. But for right now, let's get back to the ep. Have you transitioned to retiring? Because that's something that scares every athlete, including me. How's that gone?
Yeah, it's terrifying. And you know what? I've been incredibly lucky. After winning gold in 2016, I was one of the team members who hadn't signed a contract with any clubs in Holland, or, you know, gone on, because I'd already graduated, gone on to like do university degrees or go travelling. I always knew that I was going to take a break, a long extended break after 2016. So we went on and won the gold. So I just took every opportunity of probably, you get about 3 weeks after the Olympics, of getting invited onto radio stations, TV shows, panel shows. And I just went like hell for leather. I enjoyed it. Bit of a geek. So I used to go on a show and I used to do a little bit of research to engage in the conversation a bit more. Then it led on to hosting panels, to then presenting at LFC TV. And it just snowballed from there. So I've never officially done my official, I'm retiring from hockey and international hockey announcement. So although I have, I've never really had that conversation.
We're getting
conversation
you back. We're getting you back for it.
Yeah. I've not had my shirt yet. Come on.
So do you still train hockey or not? That's
no, so. I took a break after 2016, went back to club hockey at Bowden in Altrincham, played Premier League with my mate, enjoyed it. Then I had kids, went back a little bit, did Strictly, and I've not been back since. So I miss it. I miss like being in a team, but at the same time, it's the travel. Because they're still in the Premier League. Well, they were still in the Premier League, you know, going down south. It's all very southern base, training every Wednesday. Sometimes I couldn't, sometimes I could. And I said, I felt bad not being able to train on a Wednesday. Then I'd rock up and start on a Saturday. But my team were brilliant. They were like, no, we need you. We want you to start, because that gives us the best chance of winning. And then we're just with the kids getting older. I'm debating going back, though, for a social, more local. Mm-hmm. Bit of summer hockey.
Go on.
No, mate, you go for it. I've got too many questions. I'll just keep asking you questions all day. You go for it, mate.
No, I just wanted to ask you both, which we can edit in, but for someone that's listening to this, because the whole point of the podcast, Sam, is to try and obviously hear from people that are at the top of their game, and obviously for yourself as well. When you had that 3 months off, or maybe someone that's going through something similar right now that feels the pressure, it might be gymnastics, could be whatever, what's both of your advice to that person listening or watching that's maybe going through that tough time and wants to kind of refine their love for their sport?
Yeah. For me, I think, although I like the freedom, I also like love structure. So I still do it now. So having time off. So say, for example, you've got 3 months where you can just switch off. I would like dedicate a whole month, 3-4 weeks of just no training. Yeah, you can tick over, you can go for jogs, you can like maintain, but like no formal training. Eat what you want, go out with who you want, go abroad, do what you want, try something new. And then you can feel like you've done that. And then you can go, okay, for the second month, you can then reassess. Because I think if you're in sport and you're so dedicated, and people always talk about the dedication, but I think people, no disrespect, people don't understand until you're in it. I mean, the amount of friendships I lost, the amount of, you know, weddings I missed, friends 21sts, and that's where you find out who your closest and tightest lot are. And then almost like on the flip side, when you do get to the success, you realise how many people come out the woodwork. And then you've got to manage those people and what they do. But I think just reassess and do what's right for you. I think it's easy to sit here now, and I still get it in the broadcasting world, the amount of people who are a bit like, they either think you've got it or they don't. Some people choose you for a job, some people won't. And again, going back to a team sport, it's a little bit different to an individual sport. So from a team perspective, there's so many people who have different opinions on you. They either like you or they don't. And it naturally, you know, even when you're watching TV, there's presenters that it might just get on your nerves a little bit. And it's not like they're a bad person. You either like them or you don't. And it's a little bit with sport as well when it comes to selection. Yes, you want the best player for the role, but at the end of the day, it's got to be the best player for the team. Okay, what skills can they bring? You know, if that person goes off, can they fill that hole? Can they cover two, three positions? So it's just having a self-belief. And I think the self-belief borders on arrogance. And I think that's what has to get you through. And you've got to have the fire in your belly. So I think, yeah, fire in your belly and that self-belief. Otherwise, nothing else will get you through, in my opinion. What about you?
You know what? I think listening to you talk there, I feel like I should take more. I mean, it's hard to say because I'm on a break, but it's like a forced break. I think the breaks, I've always like been, I think my like insecurities push me to do too much sometimes.
What, in training wise too?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, just like lifestyle. Because I don't really have much of a life outside MMA, apart from like my family and stuff. But I've always just been like, everything is focused towards it. And I think that sometimes maybe I would perform a bit better if it wasn't. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I think maybe over the years I've pushed too much towards getting everything right. And sometimes it doesn't always go right. And you have to deal with that. Sometimes when it doesn't go right for me, I'm like, ah. Oh.
When things don't go right, do you sit and analyse what didn't go right, or do you just forget it and bin it?
Probably overanalyze it, I think. It's a tough one, isn't it? Because I always think like my mindset is what makes me a really good athlete, like the top of my game. But also I feel like it holds me back from like happiness and freedom sometimes. I know that's pretty deep, but that's the way I feel. And I think that a lot of elite athletes feel the same. Yeah. It's like they're really good at the sport because they give everything to it, but also they don't have much of a life outside of it. And I think that's why retirement scares us so much, because it's like, oh shit, if I stop doing this, I don't really have an identity to do. So did you feel like that at all when you retired? Or was it just like a natural switch from doing that to the broadcast stuff?
No, I think I completely agree with you. And I think hearing other elite athletes speak about it, it's almost like an obsessive, you have to be obsessed with it. And like you say, it's almost like a spectrum. Where on that spectrum are you obsessed and you have nothing else going on in your life, to then going too far down the other end where you're in it, but you've got too many distractions? And for me, that's, again, I probably learned that over 11 years of playing hockey, of where to put it. So when I spoke about after 2012, I probably was too far towards being a little bit obsessed to then not caring. I think for me, after I had kids, I definitely went more towards the, right, if I've fucked up, fuck it, I don't care, just forget about it. Not when it comes to like, obviously the kids and doing things wrong for the kids, but for me, whether it definitely in work, if I don't get a job, I'm like, oh, fuck it, move on to the next one. So I think that does come with age. I mean, you're much younger than me now, aren't you? How old are you?
33.
33?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm 37. I'm at like 10 years retirement now. But
it's priorities though, isn't it, as well? But that's what, listening to both of you is interesting, because I wanted to ask you about that career changing moment, because it's a bit different in hockey, that obviously you kind of saw that opportunity in broadcast and was like, right, this is the next bit now, because if you're on £12,000, obviously that's not a career that you can sustain in that aspect. So it's interesting that you both kind of had that self-belief and priorities, but then that whole balance sort of mixed into one. I was going to ask you, do you feel like, even though hockey is your passion and your love, but like now TV and entertainment is such a career down the road, was that winning that gold medal, was that the career changing moment, or was it the fact that you got you those further opportunities?
probably a bit of both. I think the gold medal, whether you like it or not, gives you the leg up.
It's pretty sick having an Olympic gold medal. That is.
But again, it's world champion like yourself, gold medals, where it puts you into a different echelon. And people might be listening now thinking, oh, she's so full of herself. But it's not. It that'll live with you. And some random woman rocked up to me in Tesco's about 3 weeks ago, put a window down. She was like, can I just say, I've just seen you there putting your trolley back. And how cool is it for you to always now, it doesn't matter if you're a daughter or your old lady, to always say you're an Olympic gold medalist. And it's so easy to go about your life and forget that because you're always focusing on the next fight, the next game and the next bit. And I quite often forget. And actually, it is important because not to draw back on your experience of what it takes to get there is so important that not a lot of people can experience or even talk about it. So again, when it comes to broadcasting and they think, okay, who are we going to get to cover the MMA when you are retired? Okay, well, let's talk to a world champion who's been there, done that and knows what it takes. So that's why you get a leg up. It's got nothing to do with in my opinion, I don't think I'm a brown nose or anything, but you are able to talk about different aspects of sport from experience. So at an Olympics, okay, we'll get her in because she can talk. What does it feel like to stand on the podium when the anthem's playing? Mm-hmm. What is it in the Olympic Village? What was life like after a gold medal? So there's all these different facets. And also on the flip side, being able to be a presenter, I feel like I can tap into athletes on a different level because you do have that common ground of what it takes to become the best.
Does that, just when you talk about that, it's interesting because I'm just constantly thinking, does that fill the void that was hockey or not?
Definitely.
It does?
Yeah. Because I prepare for live TV like I do sport.
Right.
And there's no other feeling of, you've trained for so long, you've done your homework on the oppo, you do the live you do your live match, you get the win, you get the outcome. There's no buzz like it. And it's a bit like TV. You don't go into a job blind. So you do your homework, you research, you check it all out, you do the broadcast. Obviously, you look back and as a sports person, you're like, I could have done better on that. But that same adrenaline rush and the buzz, there's nothing like it in the world than TV and sport. So I think I definitely fill that void doing live broadcast and TV. Do you think you'll want to go into that type of thing or coaching?
Oh, bring you in. I think Strictly we've decided for
Tom. Strictly's off the cards. So. I said my number, it's got to be 8.
Good footwork.
He won't do I'm a Celeb because of the food. So we've obviously got a key expert.
We've had a few people.
Oh, you've done
MasterChef. I might do MasterChef, I might do that. I'm saying I might. I've not been offered. So, but you know what? We had Chris Ramsey in, who's done Strictly.
Yeah.
H, who's been on I'm a Celeb.
Yeah. And
Ginge, who won I'm a Celeb. I don't fancy doing any of them. And then Chris Ramsey was saying, listen, everyone's got a number to do. I was like, listen, it's going to have to be 8 figures. Because I ain't done a dance with nobody for less than that.
It is true, though. So I went into I'm a Celeb straight off the back of the Olympics.
Oh, so you've done both?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Is it something that you enjoyed or not?
Yeah. I thought I'd hate it, but it was such good fun. The crew I was in there was fab. It's easier than Strictly.
Wow.
Much easier.
Did you feel at that time, was it this has gone from Olympic gold to this? Was it just almost, did you ever feel what is going on that I'm here?
I think there was a clip of me and it was an elimination task. And basically if you got into the top two, you were, what's the word? Not obscure. What's the word? When you don't get put in for eviction, for vote.
Oh, avoid.
Immune.
Immune.
Oh, smashing.
That's the one. You were immune from elimination. So I'm in this clip and I'm well, I have to come top two because no one really knows me. I play hockey and you're all so well established. I feel like I want to stay. So I need to win. So I managed to win and they used that clip. So I think that, again, put into perspective of where I was in terms of this massive lineup and it just slowly helped.
So what,
build a career.
Was it imposter syndrome at all, or did you feel like that at all, or were you just because you
still get that now?
Do you?
Yeah.
Because you've said as well, I've noticed you've said about arrogance as well. I don't feel like you come across arrogant.
I don't think so at all.
Yeah, but where does that come from?
No, it's not arrogance, but it's like a self-belief bordering on arrogance, and it's more so in elite sport because you have to believe yourself so much because you have so many knockbacks, whether that's injury, selection. You know, when you don't play very well, you have to remind yourself that you are good enough to be here. You are good enough to be selected. Otherwise, if you don't have that, you just quit. You finish. I see so many youngsters coming through now and having conversations with the senior players where the first knockback they get on non-selection, they quit. And that might be right for some people, but actually for the people who do make it to the top, who do become the best, you have to go through that to make yourself resilient enough to get to the top level. And for me, like my kids, I can't wait for my kids to get into sport. And I'm not saying elite level, but even at like grassroots, you know, you lose games, you have to learn how to lose. If you win, you have to learn how to win. If you don't get selected, if you start on the bench, because for me, that's life. You have to have resilience. Not everything goes swimmingly. So yeah, when you talk about arrogance, it's not arrogance. It's bordering on that, because you have to have so much self-belief in sport to just turn up at 6 a.m. at the gym.
Do you know what though? I always think like there's quite a big cultural difference between like people from the northwest of England and Americans. I only know because I spend so much time in the sporting world around other Americans. And I remember like when I first started fighting overseas and stuff, I would like literally feel uncomfortable being like, yeah, I'm going to win. Like sitting on camera and being like, yeah, I know I'm better than him. I'm going to win. Mm. Because I feel like someone from my area would be like, look at this dickhead. Yeah. Look at this arrogant nobby.
You're drilled. You're drilled.
But then I feel like a lot of Americans, like it's built in them from a young age. Like, you do sport, you've got to be good. You're going to win. You've got to have confidence. Whereas, I don't know, I'm not trying to like slag the northwest of England off or anything, but I feel like a lot of the time, as soon as we start getting confidence, people are like, no, you can't be that confident. You're getting cocky, you're getting arrogant. And
I agree, you get a cliff around the ear, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I don't feel like that's the way to be. I think that if you're doing anything, that you should do it like full blast, and the people around you should be like, yeah, fair play. You go full blast at it. But I literally remember I was like 25 years old fighting in the UFC, and someone asking me like, do you think you're going to win? And I'd be like, well, yeah, I do, but I don't really want to say it because if I lose, it's going to look really bad.
But if you believe, did you believe it inside?
Yeah, I believed it inside, but I just didn't want to say it out loud because I thought
it's very British.
Everyone's going to watch this and just think, what a knob.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was thinking actually when you were saying about Paddy, when I first did LFC TV, Paddy the Baddie came on and he was unknown. No one knew who he was. He obviously had the same haircut, and he came on and he was like, I'm going to be the next Conor McGregor. I'm going to be in the UFC one day and I'm going to show you all wrong. And everyone was a bit like, yeah, good one, mate. And look at him now.
Yeah, he's doing amazing.
You know what I mean? He's doing amazing. And like you say, you can believe that. As long as you believe that inside, that's fine. But it's so British of us to not like someone who actually believes in what they could be capable of. And even as a team, we used to set goals. And we used to sit there, the flip chart, and at the beginning, what do you want to achieve? This is our like short-term goal, long-term goal. And a long-term goal would be win an Olympic gold medal. Now, if you go back, and I've spoken about this with my team members of that gold medal winning team, we felt so uncomfortable putting that. Because first of all, you've got to believe it. Did we really believe it? Because we were a bit like, yeah, maybe. Because we'd never been there before. We'd never been to a semi-final at Olympics. So that belief was a bit like, But saying it out loud was like, ooh, for that exact same reason. It was arrogant. It was cocky. I'm going to win an Olympic gold medal. Everyone was like, oh God, that's so awkward. And it just a bit cheesy. Whereas I think now, haven't learned that lesson. And people talk about it all the time, don't they? If you tell yourself you're going to do something and do it well, it almost, I don't know, mentally put you into that mindset of doing everything that we used to call it the gold medal standard. So yeah, I think you are right about the Americans. They're like, I am the best, I'm going to win.
But it almost, does it counteract that imposter syndrome as well, having that self-belief and sort of almost, you say, teetering on arrogance? So when you're there, just going, right, I've got this.
You have the two voices,
the inner voice, yeah.
You have that, oh God, I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I'm tired today. What if they're stronger? What if they're quicker? What if they're more prepared? And then you have the other little voice who's like, behave. You couldn't have done more. You're prepared. You've trained as hard as you can. And again, it's just trying to balance them two voices. So when we talk about arrogance, it's just feeding the voice of self-belief actually a little bit more and shutting down that little voice of, oh, I can't. I'm not strong enough. So the imposter syndrome is still there. It still exists, which I think is important. Otherwise, you can get arrogant. You want to be at that place just before arrogance, I think, which is like a strong self-belief.
How have you dealt with the harder times, the darker times in sport, and then also when you've gone into broadcast?
Got drunk. I did. I remember not getting selected for 2012. And I remember my sister was worried about me. My older brother was worried about me. Because although I used to like going out, I'd probably do it like, once every 2 months and get leathered. But I was doing it like night after night after night. And I suppose it was my escapism because I felt embarrassed. It had been my second Olympics I'd technically not got selected for, But I think you need a good team around you. You know, people who you can trust, who actually, when you open up, they're going to tell you some hard truths. They're also going to tell you some nice truths and actually make you step back and realize, okay, this is might just be a blip, or you're going to carry on, or you're not. I remember in 2015, in the January, I captained England. I was so proud because I was like, there's a few people who can say they played for England and GB, but to say that you captained your team was massive. And I broke my rib in the first game of the tournament, managed to play on. And I didn't realise until I got home that I had two fractured ribs. And I didn't get back into the team until the following April, May. I was playing crap and I couldn't even get into like the first team, and I was getting like practice games behind shut doors. And it just spiralled, and I was like so embarrassed because it was going into Rio. The girls went and qualified. They did brilliant, and I just didn't see a way back into the team. And I literally sat at the table with my now husband, and I was like, there's just no point. I was crying. I felt hard done to. I felt like I was being the victim. I felt like I was the scapegoat. It's easy for the coach to get rid of me. He never liked me. All this going on in my head. And then I went away to Croatia for a week. I had 1 week on my own training, and I thought, right, I had my CV ready. I was like, I've got 2 weeks to either train my arse off, make sure I'm faster, stronger for when they come back. Because at a tournament, they lose fitness. And I thought, right, I've got 2 weeks. I'll train my arse off. Went back to training. We had 3 weeks of training for selection. And I managed to basically play really well. Got selected into the Euros, and then just somehow got player of the game in the final. We won gold at the Europeans for the first time in like 20 years. And then we went on to then get selected for Rio. So that for me was my pivotal moment where I just thought, I'm done. But I had a finite, you know, when you look at a calendar, I was like 2 weeks graft, 3 weeks. If I get selected, I get selected. If I don't, I'm quitting. But yeah, I was very much in the dark times. I used to get out.
Have you ever had moments like that at all?
When what? In dark times?
Yeah, just in that sense of like putting a time period on it, and also like speaking about like recalibrating yourself, you know, obviously that sounds like what, you know, through drinking and stuff like that, it did also help sort of be like, right, I need to sort myself out here in the environment. If you had moments like that?
I think the times when I was like that, so I had kids pretty young. I had my first kid when I was 23. I was 22 when, yeah, 23. And I had like no money at all. Then I had twins when I was 25. So by the time I was 25, I had like three kids and like no prospect of earning any money at all. And, then I was on a time push then, because I was like, shit, I've got like three kids, I ain't got no money. So I've like got to make it work. So the pressure was on big time then. I think stuff like that though, that like, I think when you are under a bit of pressure, that's when you start doing good. Or it was for me. I think if I wouldn't have had my kids and I would have just been like a single guy or whatever, I don't think I would be anywhere near the position that I'm in.
Do you reckon they were like your catalyst?
Yeah, to 100%.
Push on.
100%. Like if I didn't have a wife and kids, I think that if I was just like a single guy, like going out and training and fighting, I would have been nowhere near where I am now. How was it for you? Like, because you'd already retired when you had the kids.
Yeah.
But obviously you retired from sport, but you still work in other areas.
But I'm the same as you though. Like there's so many things that I want. I need that like pressure, like even to go out. If I know I need to do something, I'm very last minute. And I always joke with my husband, like I work better under pressure. Yeah. Whether it's like getting packed for holiday, I'll leave it to 2 days before. Or if it's like getting outfits, for example, to Aintree, I'm like, I'm already in the process and it's the earliest I've ever done it. And I know I've got to get it done this week because I can't next week because I'm dead busy. So I don't know, like my motivation, I don't know. It just, I always have to have some sort of...
Sounds like Rio was that for you though, at that point.
Yeah, at that point it was like selected or not.
Yeah.
Not that it wasn't going to, it's just weird. But again, it's just the...
How is it like, because I find that a lot of really successful people have kids. How is it being like, you said recently you did some stuff for the Super Bowl. Obviously, that's like a massive event. So you're working all these massive events, round loads of people, you're under pressure, and then you walk home, your kids fell over, cut his knee or whatever.
It removes you.
You're just like, what? Like 2 hours ago, I was at the Super Bowl, and now you're whinging because you're hungry. Like, how's that?
Probably the same as you. You kind of walk through the door, doesn't it? And like any sort of, you know... stardom or
they don't give a shit.
I'll carry your bag, don't worry ma'am, and it's like, no, that's right, I can carry my own, goes out the window. They don't care.
It grounds you.
Yeah, all they want is the mum, the dad home to tell you about the day, show you this drawing or whatever it is. It definitely does.
Yeah, they don't give a shit. It's like my oldest son, So when I won the title, I was in New York, fought Madison Square Garden, sold out and all that. And there's obviously a time difference. So when I FaceTimed home, I was like holding up my belt and that, yeah, showing my son. And this was a few years ago now. This was, so he would have been around 7-ish. And his reaction was like, oh, that's nice. I've just got a new book. I'm just like, yeah, fair enough. I'll just enjoy it when I'm here. And then you know that when you get home, it's just like...
Well, how sick is it though when they get to that, to like a level of kind of not intelligence, that like a level of actually caring and understanding. Yeah. That's probably the best word. A level of understanding of what you've achieved. What would you say to him if he wants to go into MMA? Like, would, you know, in terms of when to start, when's the right time or anything?
I hate this question, honestly. So I get asked all the time, as you will with hockey and stuff, by parents,
yeah,
all the time coming up to me, oh, my kid wants to start MMA, or my kid's doing MMA, what should you do? He wants to be a UFC fighter, he wants to be a UFC champion, whatever it is. And then people obviously asking about my kids. Are your kids fighting? When are they going to start training? And I'm just like, I would advise against it.
Mm.
It's difficult. It's really difficult to say because I don't know what I'd be without MMA. At the same time, I'm in the top probably 1% who's able to look after the family and made generational wealth and done what I wanted to do from it.
Mm.
Whereas most people, and when I say most, I mean 99% of the people who I know who do MMA, they've been retired at 35, absolutely banged up body, no money, and then they've got to go and do a normal job. And that's like literally 99% of the people. So it's whether you want to take that risk. I think MMA is such an amazing sport for mental clarity because you've got something that you've got to focus on all the time. Learning how to defend yourself, which is useful for anybody, I think. Even like basic stuff like coordination, discipline, all that kind of stuff's great. As far as doing it from a profession, for a way to feed your family and achieve your goals, I would say do a sport that you're more likely to do well at. It's really hard to say though, because I absolutely love MMA. I wouldn't change my journey for anything, yeah, but it's been fucking really hard.
What percentage, and it's probably different for each and different sports, is it down to like natural talent and ability to then hard work, to then commitment? Like what is the most overriding skill that you need then for MMA to be successful? Because really, like all these kids, like this, they come up to you, okay, well, mine wants to play for England. It's like, well, in hockey, it has to be like 100% resilience. Mm. What would it be in MMA?
It's a very subjective question. I think you need to... I honestly don't even know where to start with the answer. You need to be good at everything. The thing is with MMA is it's really tough physically, but it's also, I would argue, it's tougher mentally.
Mm.
Because getting into a mental space where you have to prepare to fight somebody in front of millions of people is really tough. I would say that the thing that you need more than anything is confidence. I think it's such a scary thing to do, to take your shirt off and go and fight somebody in front of millions of people. And it's not for everybody. I see... I've said it a million times just to people I know, like Charlie and stuff. There's so many guys who I train with and they're literally like unbelievable in the gym. And we're talking UFC fighters. We're talking like the top level. And then they'll be in a fight, like a live combat situation, and they'll just be nothing like they are in the gym every day. And it's such a difficult thing to be able to transition from like doing it when no one cares to doing it when the whole world's watching. I think that's the biggest difference, is like the mental aspect of being able to perform really good under like massive pressure is the difference.
Yeah, that is mad. Because it was this, I remember making an argument being like, again, in team sport, you get people who train brilliantly and it's like, well, you're selected, but then they get on the pitch and it's like, well, where's that player?
Yeah.
Whereas I was 100%, like I'd train hard, but in terms of like, you know, going around cones, technically I wasn't great, but actually put me on a pitch and make a tackle and pass it on. Skillful enough to play the game, but like you say, when it comes to pressure, I've always wanted to know though, how do you, when you talk about that mindset of being able to take your shirt off and get into a fight, what do you think about? Because you have to go into like that mode, isn't it? It's like fight or flight.
I think for the uneducated person, you would think that MMA fighters are like quite angry, like alpha people. Most of the people that I know are at the top level, like it's a are actually like quite nerdy and articulate.
Yeah.
Because it is like, even though it doesn't look like it, it's quite a thinking man sport, thinking person sport. You're just doing a sport. That's the way I look at it, is like.
So when you're getting like your, like, you know, you get a hit or anything, what's the first initial thing that goes through your head? Is it like an anger of I'm going to lose?
No, that's the worst thing you can do, is get angry.
Is that when people just lose all
the technique?
That's when
you're definitely going to lose.
I would genuinely say, being around Tom on Fight Week, it's probably we've spoken about all that anxiety and training and everything you've spoke about. Tom in Fight Week is probably the most relaxed and calm. Like, obviously I don't know what's going on inside, but being around him, it's when he's most relaxed. And even on a fight day, him and his dad are just like, it's like they're doing the fight that they first did when Tom was 8 years
old. Yeah, if you're like getting angry, that's literally the word. You can't do it. You just can't do it.
Are there some fighters who use that?
Not very good ones.
I love that. That's fascinating. Because naturally, I think, especially if you take one, you want to like...
Well, that's the difference between being really good and just being good. Like, naturally, like, for example, I've only been dropped like a handful of times in my career. The first time I got dropped, I got up and I was like, right, you're having it now. Like, you're... And then I got dropped again. But then that was in one fight. Then a few fights later, I got dropped again. And I was like, I learned from the first one. I'm like, right, just take the rest of the round, just try and recover, get your breath back, get like your senses back, and then we can get him later on. You know what I mean? It's these little things, and you just learn from experience, don't you? I think if you're going to get hit and try and hit him back straight away, it's just a tactical disaster. It's just not going to work. You're just going to get hit twice as hard. It's just not going to work. But I think, like, from the outside looking in, you'd think that's exactly what you should do.
Mm.
But it's the wrong thing.
Yeah,
most of the time.
Just goes.
Yeah.
Please talk to me about the penalty shootout 2016. What's going through your mind?
I was shin pads off, stick down. My job was done.
But still, it's so much. It meant so much to everything.
It meant so much. And again, it comes down to like preparation, doesn't it? And being as prepared for that moment in time. You know, in practice, we'd have, so five take the penalties or the shuttles, and you'd probably have like another five who were then the backup. And we'd be like stood there, like shouting all sorts at them, whispering in their ear, like doing anything we could to like put them off or put the pressure on. Because ultimately, you can't replicate that feeling of, okay, if you win this, you win an Olympic gold medal. There's no way possibly that you can replicate that. So in terms of the mindset, very similar to you, people think, oh my God, you must have been so nervous. But actually, we were all like mega calm. And I think we were actually really confident, because if you go back to the footage as well, the way the game panned out, we all sprint back in to say, okay, what's the brief now? Like, we're going into penalties. The Dutch head down and walking back to the coach. And for us, like, we noticed that was huge. But the year prior to that, with the European gold medal, we were 2-0 down, came back 2-2 and won on penalties. So it was almost like a little bit of a repeat for us. And we had like this confidence, this calmness to then go in and know what we could do. And also the amount of footage, the video footage, what does the goalkeeper do? Okay, that's their strength, because under pressure, you go to your probably best skill or your most comfortable skill. So everything is just already predetermined. And again, you talk about mindset in elite performance. Again, got to the final. I'd never been so nervous for a hockey game in my life. You know, again, even when you go back to the European final. For the first time in my career, I was like physically shaken, because I used to get butterflies, but if I did the prep, I knew my oppo, I was actually dead relaxed. And I remember going onto the pitch shaking, and I made a pass which I never make, which was in the inside when there was a forward there. She intercepted it, and she was basically one on one with our goalkeeper, and I basically like took her out, slid her, and it was 0-0 at this point, and gave away like a penalty flick. And like, I died inside, like the flashbacks of, oh my God, they've lost the Olympic gold because of Sam Quirk. And again, it was because I had that reaction of panic, anger, oh crap, make a big, massive tackle. And I'd never been sent off my whole hockey career. But then after that flick, our goalkeeper Maddie thankfully saved it. It was almost, that was a bit of a reset to then go back to the calm, right, we've practiced this. What happens, you know, when we're at Bisham Abbey? You're 1-0 down, how do you react? It's 2-1. You need to score two goals. You've got 3 minutes left to win or qualify. So it all comes down to just preparation, so that actually when it gets to that moment, you don't feel, you know, that, okay, what now type of situation.
It's really interesting hearing from both. It's preparation, isn't it, over and over again?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time it is. It's just like your body just falls into what it knows. Do you feel like that as well?
Yeah, it is. It's like, it's basically, it's under pressure, I think, on what it knows and what feels comfortable. I mean, it's been a while since I've been there. I'm probably going to try and pick up a stick at some point. But there will be like certain skills that you know that you can do and it'll be...
Yeah, you just do them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But someone chasing their own gold medal in whatever way you want to look at it, what would your advice be to them?
Just don't give up until it's over, in my opinion. And again, resilience, take the knockbacks, learn from them. But again, don't overanalyze the knockbacks. Don't overanalyze the losses. Because again, I think I did that earlier on in my career. I used to sit at video and look at all the reasons why I may have turned the ball over. So why did it pass? Why did it pass? Why did they tackle me so easily? And it would took our new sports psychologist, Andrea, to come in and say, Sam, watch 5 clips. Don't watch 20. Hopefully I didn't make that many in one game, but over a course of certain games, she was like, look at 5, because by then you've learned. If you watch any more, you're then teaching yourself what you're watching. Go and watch the stuff of, okay, why did it go well? So go and watch the clips of, that was a brilliant, you know, elimination of the attacker. You won the ball, whatever it may be. You passed it on, you put a through ball. Go and watch that and see how and why did you do it well? So you start focusing on the things that you can control. And I think that's when my playing career almost got better and I became a much better all-round player, especially when I wasn't in my own head. I became a crap player basically when I got in my own head, for all the reasons of don't pass it, don't give it away, don't give it away. But as soon as you get the confidence, okay, I'm going to do that, this is what works. It's almost like a shift. And I found that's when it's probably your maturity, I think, was with how I was working. It's probably how I became a better athlete as well.
No, that's great advice. A question that everyone always says is, what would you say to younger Sam? But what would you say to future Sam with everything to look forward to? Obviously, the kids growing up, careers evolving all the time. What would you say to future Sam? What would be your words to her?
Probably the same. Try not to focus on what I can't control, because there's so much stuff that you can waste your energy on. And I think I've learned, again, in broadcasting, even now, there's, you know, a finite amount of roles. So again, you put it in parallels with like sport that you might not be someone's cup of tea for, but someone else's. So, you know, if a door closes, you don't get the job, you know, don't focus on it. That's their decision. That's what they wanted. Yeah, you might not have been the best person. It's almost just accepting that in a positive way and then taking on the next opportunity. So for me, yeah, just to keep chipping away, keep working hard. I want my kids, as I say, to get into sport. But ultimately just, yeah, control what you can control. I think I've learned that, because you can waste so much energy, can't you? Like stressing, even in like the current affairs, like I've decided to come off Twitter now because I spent the day listening to radio. I'm normally like full sports, podcasts, cheesy music. And I thought, I wonder what's going on with like this whole, you know, Iran situation. And I literally, like I said to my husband, I came home and I just felt sad and down and was like, what's the point? And it's like, it's important what is going on in the current world. But again, I feel like I can't control any of that at the moment. So I just try not to focus on it and just focus on what I can control. And, you know, a bit of time off, that's for me, being a good mum, picking my kids up on time. I can sometimes be late, making sure they've got a good packed lunch. And it may sound crap, but for me, that's what's important for me at the moment. Or if I've got, you know, I'm doing the LFC Legends game for the foundation at the weekend, going along, taking the kids for their first match, my husband, my family to enjoy. Just go, have a nice time, enjoy. Yeah, I'll do the work, see who's playing, figure out some questions that we may have to use if we overrun so that I'm fully prepared going into that, because that's what I can control. But it's just, yeah, I think the older you get, I think you realise life's too short, innit? Just have fun while you can. And it's so cliche.
Love that.
So cliche.
What would your advice be to Tom when he transitions out of sport as well?
Well, steady on. I'm still trying to enjoy it. Buddy,
well, no, you got to get all your advice.
Get me a job. Right. Oh.
Yeah. get your notes, mate.
Yeah, we'll start off our own show. It'll be great. I think, first of all, you need to make sure that you're ready to retire. Do you know what I mean?
The thing is with sport, especially my sport, the sport ends up retiring you. I don't want to be one of them.
Do you not?
I don't
want
to be.
You don't want people to be like, oh, he's past it, he should have retired.
I don't think it's people. It's more like your body, like, start getting hit, start getting knocked out.
Well, yours is the difference between life and death, though. Let's be blunt.
I mean, I hope mine's, they won't die.
Someone got past you and scored a goal.
Hopefully yours they don't die.
You were saying about your eye injuries as well. Shattered hockey balls. I mean,
professional sport, people get dangerous. Injured. But I think with MMA, it's like your body just gives up on you. Like, people get old. They say, there's a saying in MMA, like, you get old overnight. I think it's pretty true. Like, what? Because we have such a long time between fights. We like 3 months, six months. Sometimes it can be a year.
Do you think people can feel that, though, even when you're in, like, training camp? So that then that could potentially affect confidence, like you talk about going into a fight, and that's when people retire.
Maybe. I don't know. I think some people's, it sounds pretty brutal, and it is. Some people's brains are taking too much punishment, and like they get hit and the brain switches off quick and just goes unconscious. That happens a lot. And then your body's looked like, I've had about 30-ish fights, and I've not took much damage in the fights a lot of the time, but that also means I've had 30 plus training camps, which means that's like a lot of miles on the clock. And I don't have that many fights. There's some people who've had 60, some people who've had 80, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's the training that also takes out of you. So yeah, it's just a lot, especially being a bigger guy, it's a lot of pressure on the joints and stuff like that. So yeah, I just don't want to be one of those guys who's getting knocked out every time I fight.
Do you not think it's environment, though, as well? Did you have someone say to you, obviously, right, Sam, this is your opportunity now, let's go? Because your dad always says that.
Yeah, my dad will be on top. It's like, you see what's going on with Tyson Fury and his dad?
Yeah.
Like, Tyson Fury's dad's basically just come out and said he should have retired like three fights ago. And I mean, I don't want to overstep the mark because I know Tyson and John, but when you look at the way the Deontay Wilder fights went and you look at what Deontay Wilder's like now, and it's like, wow, he is really gone after that. And it's going to be interesting, Tyson's next
fight.
It's
weird, though, because again, like, people will naturally just be like, well, it's for the money. And like, as a boxing fan, as a sports fan, that's what, when you see people who aren't potentially at where they are, and then you've got to be, well, fair enough, because he's providing for his kids, his family. Because surely that has to be a... The balance between getting, like you say, a head injury or
it is, but dangerous, I think sport just consumes you, though, doesn't it? It's like those guys in particular, they'll be getting somewhere between 20 and 50 million for a fight. So it's like, how much money does a person need? So it's like, you know, 10 million, it's definitely going to look after your generation of kids. So you don't need that much more after that, but you're just probably doing it because that's who you are, I think.
Yeah.
That's what how much money does one person need? Whether you're getting 10 million or 100 million, it's a lot of millions, and it essentially isn't going to do anything, I think.
I think a lot of, again, it's easy to say people do it for the money, but we go back to, we've still got to get up and into the gym, work hard.
I think it just consumes you, doesn't it? You've done it for so long. Like, I've trained martial arts since I was 9. What would I do without it? I don't know.
But also it's the balance as well. Like, for example, your eye injury, and I've got your wife messaging me saying, like, can he see his kids and stuff like that? There's also the reality of that and the actual balance of it.
I don't know how people with kids do elite sport. And like, I've heard people taking kids away on training camp, but I know personally for me, I couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't even work with my kids with me. I'd be too distracted and too, are you okay? Can I do that? Are they okay? And like, I don't know how you do it.
I think it's definitely, I mean, this is going to ruffle a lot of feathers, but I think it's definitely easier for a man than it is a woman. Because I think that a woman,
no, say it. I will 100% back you up because I've had the conversation with my
husband. I think that as a man who's got small kids, who are a bit older now, but especially when they were smaller, I think a woman is way more naturally in tune with the small kid than a man is. I found it quite hard to be like naturally know what my kid needed when they were little, especially before they could talk and stuff.
Yeah.
I just feel like, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like women are way more in tune with kids.
Yeah, it's. I think definitely, like you say, at that first like 6 months a year.
Yeah.
Because like that natural bond that happens. But again, I speak to my husband about it. He always says to me, Sam, go and have a nap or go and switch off. And I just can't, because even when I'm lying there to nap, I'm like, I really should be doing that. I should be doing this for the kids. Whereas Tom says, I don't know, I just, whether we are wired different as women and men, because he is a great dad. I go to America to do Super Bowl. He looks after the kids and I'm so fortunate. And like, thank God he's just so amazing. He dives headfirst into it. But the whole time I'm away, I'm like feeling bad. I'm doing that. He's like, go away, work. You're doing it for the family. Whereas when he switches off, he'll go and be like, right, I've got 3 hours without the kids now. I'm going to go and play on the Xbox or go and have a nap. And guys can switch off completely.
Yeah.
But on the flip side as well, like we went out at the weekend and I was like, the kids are staying here. And mum was like, yes. But like, and he was like, oh, I'm going to miss them overnight. I was like, do you know what I mean? So he still has that bond. But I think, I don't know how fellas, I'm so jealous that you can switch off. And I, like, and I don't know if it's like a biological thing.
I don't know because I
like,
know a
we
lot
are notorious of being like, oh, I should have done that. Like the kids will go down, they're like, oh, I should have done that. I should have fed them healthier stuff. I shouldn't have shouted at them when I did. Mm. It's just a constant replay in your mind. So again, going back to being an elite sports person.
A lot of fighters though, it's quite a common thing to like go away to training camps where they'll leave the family for like 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever. Go somewhere else completely away so they don't see the family at all so they can get like in a different headspace for training. I wouldn't like that. I don't do that because I like to like we spoke about before, have that like normality of coming back home and being like, take your mind off it because otherwise I'm just going to think about it all day and night. Yeah. But everyone's like these female fighters who got kids, they're bringing the kids to watch them fight and I'm just like, wow, that wild. Like,
mummy's strong.
Imagine being 5 years old watching mum have a cage fight with someone. It's crazy.
Yeah, in the playground with the bullies. My mum's going to kick your head.
The final question that we always ask our guests, Sam, when the pressure's at the highest for you, what is going on inside your mind?
Again, it's them two voices, isn't it? That, oh my God, panic, or that it's fine. You've done the preparation, you know what you're going to do. Probably the latter. Again, doing American football this season, there's been many a times when you may lose the American feed, the feed goes down on live TV and you have to manage that situation. And in my head, if I hadn't have done the work or the preparation, I'd be panicking in my head like, oh my God. And it would be like the longest 5 minutes of my life. But if I've done the preparation, the work, then I'm like, sound, let's chat more about the game. Let's talk about this player. Okay, this is what they did last week. And again, it's same as when I was a hockey player. If I hadn't have done the fitness sessions, the running sessions, the weight sessions, the SWOT analysis, then you go into the game just being nervous and a bit unsure. So yeah, definitely under pressure, calm, it's fine. You know what you need to do, I think.
Love it. Thank you so much. You enjoyed it, mate.
That was great. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks appreciate for having
it. Me. Are you going to follow Sam? That's the big question.
Realise I didn't. Apologies, I will follow you. I mean, you don't need it. I don't need to apologise. You're not like losing sleep over it.
No, I'm not really.
Sam, but I will.
Where can we find you though? On socials and stuff like that? And anything that you want to plug or anything that's to come as well?
Yeah, so on socials, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Been locked out of my TikTok. I don't know how to get back on. Not been on that since Strictly.
Tom can help you with that.
So if you've got any contacts big at TikTok.
I've never been on TikTok in my life.
No, I've not.
No.
It's another platform for people to try and like inbox you. And okay.
Charlie gets fuming because I've got loads of TikTok followers that think it's me.
But you've got YouTube though, haven't you?
YouTube's flying.
There we go.
YouTube's flying. Okay. Yeah, we're doing well.
But yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. That has been Sam Quirk. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Next time, Paddy McGuinness.
Right. Anyone in the mood for a bit of comedy? Silence.
Your weight transformation, mate.
What's the secret?
What's the secret?
From day one to the finished thing, it's amazing when you look back and you go, Jesus Christ, I can't believe the difference. And I did it. Put it out there on my socials. Gets a call from Men's Health. We do front cover for us. So that's a big deal, Tom, isn't it? I equated earning money to being successful. Success isn't just about what you've got in the bank.